Hello, everybody. Yeah, you guessed it. I'm still John Atack, and today we have the treat of talking with my dear friend and colleague Hoyt Richards. Hi, Hoyt.
Hey, John, good to see you as always. Have you
Yeah,
been?
it is. It's terrible. It's terrible. Enjoying this so much. It's not meant. It's meant to be hard. It's meant to be difficult life. Not meant to enjoy it. There's a wonderful line in a Björk song where she says, "It's not meant to be a struggle uphill." Talking of life, Oh,
Yeah.
and it's not. It's not. Though I don't think it's actually meant to be anything personally. It's what we
Well,
do.
yeah. I wish there was a life guidebook, but doesn't. I haven't been able to find that issue out there. Yeah.
Yeah, and when you do, I mean, there are things like Maimonides, The Guide of the Perplexed, which is an excellent 11th century textbook on how to live your life. I didn't manage to get all the way through it, but he starts with the first paragraph. So this is nearly 1,000 years ago, and he says, of course, when it says in Torah in the Old Testament that man is created in the image of God, it doesn't mean anything physical. You're going, wow, there's some insight. And the Tao Te Ching, that's always quite a good guide. But there's
I've been
so much
reading
more.
this. You ever read Marcus Aurelius?
Yes, I have bits and pieces. I among the Stoics, I prefer Epictetus, the Greek, or the Chinese Zhang Zi, because Marcus Aurelius, although his stoicism seems to me a God, we just have to put up with it sort of attitude, whereas Epictetus and Zhang Zi are saying, yeah, isn't it brilliant being alive? I prefer that attitude.
Well, I guess because he was an emperor and all, in this position of power, it's a
And
fascinating.
starred in Gladiator, of course.
And it's fascinating to see someone. I mean, this the manual, whatever the book, came about because it was his own personal diary of his thoughts that he wanted to remind himself of how to be a better person and how to not abuse his power and how to kind of remember that he's in service of others and not to control him, because he's in that time and era where everyone just kind of pilfered and indulged and took advantage. And
Pretty
so it's
much
in,
like now.
yeah, yeah. No, it is remarkable how much things haven't changed. I mean,
Yeah.
obviously I'm dealing with the translation. I don't know what the original might be, in particular, but it's very, very, it resonates with a lot of me. I thought it was very powerful. A friend of mine suggested it. I've enjoyed that.
Isn't it true that there's a co-author, and the co-author was Marcus Aurelius's slave?
Oh, I didn't know that. No, that was I didn't see no.
So enslaving other people was fine, but as long as you did it in an ethical way,
Oh
and you
boy.
beat them 3 times a day.
Oh my goodness. Or at least on coordinated time, so they knew when it was coming, right?
Yeah, that's it. Fair warning.
Oh
Right.
God.
So we yeah. Should we talk about the I Got Out storytelling
Yes, I thought
conference
we should,
first? Because that
because
sounds
I.
fascinating.
Yeah, I was just there last weekend, a week ago, and my role in this was to be the MC. So, but I got out the organization, which I'm on the board of directors, and the whole premise is for people to have a safe forum to tell their stories. They can do it either anonymously or with their own ownership, and this was the first kind of live event where we actually had given people like 5 to 7 minutes to perform their story in whatever way they thought suited them best. Some people read a poem, some people sang a song, some people did, told their story in kind of a stand-up comedian kind of way.
That's
And
certainly the way I try to approach it.
And it was really, and I tell you, besides the courage it took, and a lot of people had never gone public before, which I thought was really, really wonderful to witness. And I found it was a sold out crowd. It wasn't a large space, but probably 120 people or so. And it was like an improv place in St. Louis. And it was fascinating to watch how supportive the crowd was. And I don't know how much of the crowd was people who were supporting people they knew in there, or people who had just come off the street and had heard about it some way or another. I mean, it was one of the things we talked about afterwards. I said, I probably would have been helpful to try to determine how well, because we had done some press and a couple articles have been written about it. So there might have been walk-ins and there might have been people actually lending support to friends they knew that were, you know, going out on stage. But people came from all over the country. And I just thought it was an interesting thing to not only witness, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of tension that goes into doing anything public. You know, they talk about public speaking being one of the most challenging things that anybody ever does.
Which I personally now find very strange. I used to find it really difficult when I first came to this kind of work at the age of 28, being in a room with 20 people and, you know, having them want me to say things. And now, oh, look at me.
Yeah. Well, and I think it is a result of repetition and experience. I really do. And so, having been someone who's been telling my story for almost two decades now, I'm not close to you, but, you know, it's
you are close to me, Hoyt.
Well, yeah. Thank you, John. But it's, yeah, it was interesting to kind of see and remember what it's like to finally go in front of people and you know, a live audience too. I mean, that's, you know, when I went public the very first time, I did it on like a television show where, you know, they interviewed me for 45 minutes and it ended up being like a 3 or 4 minute clip, you know, and of course they edited it to their agenda, and it was not a very pleasing experience to kind of witness what it ended up being, what went public. But it was, you know, my baptismal fire of realizing that it's never going to go perfect. You know, you can't control these things ultimately, and you certainly can't control how people are going to react. And I think, you know, it's a very brave thing that you just at a certain point have to choose to embark, and hopefully for reasons that feel healthy to you. I mean, yeah. I can really say from my point of view, like I encourage anyone to tell their story in whatever capacity they feel comfortable in. And usually that would be just confiding in a friend, maybe confiding in a family member. I've had extraordinary conversations with people at airports because I know I'm never going to see them, you know, and there's this safe zone to like interact with a human and know there's going to be no ripple effect to the words you're speaking, potentially, at least that you're going to experience in your own life directly. And so I just think it's one of these things of where that journey of learning to confront your trauma, take ownership of it, and through that mechanism of kind of dealing with it, you start to hopefully recognize that your only solution that I've been able to determine is to find some way to communicate what you went through with someone else other than, like, the self-reflection is a huge part of it, but then you need to get it out in some way and communicate to others and try to get some kind of litmus test from someone else's reaction of how they're hearing it, or you discovering that you didn't tell it very well and there's a better way to tell it and to investigate. Well, what's a better way for me to communicate what I felt or what I experienced? And I think that whole process facilitates a ton of healing. And I mean, it may get messy at first because you just don't know what you're doing a little bit, and you're nervous and you're scared and those sort of things. But as you and I, you know, and we've talked about this in the past about dealing in absolutes and how, you know, destructive that can be and have that kind of dualistic way of thinking. But I can't say I've discovered one absolute that I feel confident in expressing, and that is if you've experienced trauma, which I think none of us go through life without doing, you know, some form of that.
We all get born, and that's quite difficult. Yeah.
And if you make the choice to not, you know, deal with your trauma, then I can pretty much guarantee you will not heal. So I think that's the only absolute I feel confident really standing by. But I do feel if you do start to investigate and deal with it and take ownership of it, it might be a little bumpy at the beginning, but ultimately things will move around and you'll start to learn. And ultimately this trauma, which many of us tend to run from or carry a lot of shame around, can actually become this resource of information that could become a source of empowerment.
Yes.
By making that choice to take ownership of it. So I'd be curious to get your thoughts about how you think about people telling their story, owning their story, you know, how to do it, you know, when to go public and those sort of things. I thought it would be nice to have a little discourse about that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really important area. I think the first thing is, you know, I couldn't agree more that by telling our story, we understand ourselves. We understand what's happened to us. And trying to, you know, I can understand that if you've been in the hands of torturers, and some cult members have been in the hands of torturers, that you really don't want to reflect upon that. You really don't want to re-experience that. And so the tendency is to push it away. And that's understandable. I've long advocated Ronnie Janoff Bullman's book, Shattered Assumptions, and which is, you know, she's a genius. The insight that she has into recovery, I found, you know, and I came to it having been working around that field for two or three decades by that time. But here's somebody who understands that. So, for example, she talks about denial and she says, well, maybe denial's a normal, healthy process to go, no, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to think about it, because a person may not be ready. So that's the first stage that it might be difficult. But as you say, self-reflection is one thing, and we can tie ourselves in awful knots trying to work out on our own what happened.
Right.
If you can then find somebody sympathetic, and the first quality is somebody who can listen and who doesn't want to tell you what to think or give you advice about you, or worst of all, tell you how stupid you were to get involved.
Right.
As our friend, good friend Yuval Lahore says, you know, joining a cult is like stepping in dog mass. That's it. There's the blame. You know, you put your foot in the wrong place.
Right.
So, you know, I've met people who, you know, 30 years after leaving were still going, why was I so stupid? And it's like, you just weren't looking at the ground, you know, that moment.
Yeah.
Your attention was somewhere else. And the mechanisms involved in getting us to belong to a group, which we've also talked about, are so elaborate, and our need to belong is so strong. And our, especially, you know, when I used to be young and foolish. I'm now old and foolish. And but it's given me the advantage of experience to be able to say, well, maybe there isn't a purpose to the universe. Maybe there isn't meaning in human activity. Maybe we're just being arrogant about who we are and what we are. So this thought that there's somebody there who can tell me how to live is always going to be false, because in the end, as the Buddhists say, you have to lose the desire to become Buddha. You have to let go of all of the teaching, everything that's been put on you, if you are going to be free. And it's a matter of how quickly you can get to that. And I think that integrating and digesting your bad experiences and learning from them, you know, what could be more important, you know, to integrate this into your life and make something useful of it. So find somebody who's sympathetic, or do it anonymously. Mm-hmm. And, you know, which is, you know, that's a tremendous benefit of the internet. It's not actually as safe as most people think it is. You know, your anonymous tag can be traced back to your IP number if you're not very careful.
Right.
But unless you're, you know, coming from a very vindictive group that's going to hunt you down, and there are thankfully only a small number of those, but they do exist, unless you're going to be hunted down, then they're going on you know, the web somewhere, onto a forum, a message board, and talking about your experience. For most people, for the vast majority of people, it's cathartic. It makes them feel better. And then going the next stage, which is where, for you and I, you know, I certainly don't feel traumatized by my experience in Scientology. I never have, though. Whereas your experience was deeply traumatizing, you know, the whole
thing,
you know, nothing like that happened to me. But for almost everyone I've met, that there is that trauma to deal with. And there's this idea of, you know, EMDR, that by, you know, watching a finger, you can get over trauma. And it comes out of, you know, hypnotherapy, out of Ericksonian and neurolinguistic programming and things like that. And I get that it might be helpful in reducing the traumatic response and is therefore a good thing. But I still hang on to the thought that until I've understood something, until I've integrated and digested it, I haven't actually overcome it. I'm just shoving it somewhere else. I know many, many people who've walked out of a group and said, I'm done with that. It's over. For example, Kerry Gleason. Kerry was the executive director international of Scientology, which, you know, as far as we knew, meant he was running it. He wasn't. Hubbard was running it. And he was junior to the Watchdog Committee. But nonetheless, he was a very high-ranking Scientologist. Mm-hmm. And I finally got him. He was in England. I got him to come and have dinner. And we had dinner. It was very nice. And I started the interview. And it was a very short interview. I said, so what do you think about Scientology now? And he said, it's shit. And that was his whole statement. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here. At the time, he was earning his living selling Ron Hubbard's management ideas.
Oh, my goodness.
So you've got this conflict in the guy. And seeing if you don't face it, or Scientologists would say confront it, if you don't face it, it doesn't go away. It's still sat in the corner of the room. You've put a blanket over it, but the beast is still there. And there will be times when it will afflict you. There'll be times when it will bite you. And the more remote you make it and the less willing you are to face it, the more dangerous it becomes. So I think it is important. It's also important to get a balance and to not spend your time living in a mess.
No. Know?
Have exactly. real life good experiences, get that working too.
You know, I one of the things you said that really resonates with me is, you know, when you're trying to find a compassionate person to talk with initially, you know, and it's one of the things I feel like I've learned through life and certainly dealing with my own experience and trauma, that I always picture it as when someone's going through something that you can relate to on some level, and they're basically describing that they feel stuck in this hole of sorts, you know, and they don't know the way out. You know, most people think, oh, well, then here, let me show you the ladder so you can get out, and that's a really not
my cult.
And what I found is, what's the most useful to anyone is, like you said, listen, being able to listen, and then also do your best to put yourself in the same hole with them and basically say, hey, doesn't it suck down here? This is terrible. It really is. And actually, this reminds me of a time when I was in the hole, you know, of sorts, and this is how I dealt with it, you know? And so you're not giving a person solutions. You're just identifying with the feelings and with the sense of this almost hopelessness that you experience when you're kind of in that kind of despair, and recognize you're not alone, and that it seems to be not only part of the human experience or condition, but it's only temporary too. You know, you can speak from the point of view of, hey, I've been there. Hey, you know, it was hard. It sucked. But I found my way out by doing this and that, you know, or this is what I found was helpful for me when I was dealing with these sort of feelings. And you just kind of share space and hold space for that person so they feel comfortable telling their story. And that's a huge thing, and not necessarily an easy type of person to find at first, because I think, you know, especially when you're if you're talking to guys, you know, men in general want to be problem solvers, and so they just, you know, well, tell me what it is, and I'll fix it, and that's not necessarily what you need at that time. So it can be a bit challenging to find those type of people, but I think that's where you get things moving a little bit, and you start to. You know, I think it's the benefit of therapy. You know, we talk about self-reflection. The way we talk to ourselves in our self-reflective way can be very different of an experience when we actually articulate what we're thinking inside our head to someone else. When it comes out of our mouth, we're like, oh my God, do I really look at it that way? Because something about hearing it out loud creates an opportunity to kind of identify our thoughts in a different way than if we just keep them in our head. And I don't know if you've had that experience as well.
Every day. But I find it's really important to express what I think. It's really important to express what I believe, whether I write it down or I speak it. And they're different pathways and require, you know, there's recent work that is pushing against the idea that there are, you know, Wernicke's and Broca's area in the brain and they determine meaning and grammar. That there's now work saying that actually language is a whole brain experience, and which seems right to me in the same way that memory is a whole brain experience. It's not just there's a place where there's a little memory and you pull it out. The whole brain, or, you know, various areas of the brain, of the 200 brain regions, are collaborating to make this thing. And I unfortunately have quite often found that when I'm talking about something that I realize I haven't understood it. You know, there's some, you know, and often that sometimes it's because somebody will ask me a pertinent question, and sometimes it's because I'll get halfway into saying something and go, actually, is that true? You know, do I really understand what's going on here? So articulating something's very important. I think another aspect of this, which I've advocated now for, you know, nearly 40 years, is that small groups of well-meaning former members getting together, and I mean small, you know, under a dozen people sitting together, whether you do it through Zoom or in the room, and talking about their experiences, but also talking about the beliefs. And this is something that all too often doesn't seem to be considered in recovery. And the question is, what do I still believe? To extricate yourself from a belief system is like the Benjamin Franklin pros and cons thing. That if you think everything that happened to you is bad and evil and everything you believed was wrong, then you probably are in a difficult place. If you still believe that it's all right, you're definitely in a difficult place. And sorting that out takes away the control that the belief system will otherwise continue to have. So, you know, if I'm asked by therapists how they should approach cult members, it's, well, firstly, you deal with the cultic shell. You deal with the identity or pseudo-identity that's been created by the group, because otherwise you're counseling that identity. So somebody is still passing all the information through the cult's ideas. So getting somebody to the first breakthrough, which is saying, the cult leader said this, and also this, which contradicts it. That's quite an important one in going, so the cult leader is fallible. And it's the fallibility that becomes significant. Or the cult leader, you know, reported this as factual, which isn't. So bringing the cult leader down to a human level and then being able to question the dogma. The reason I came back in 2013 after 17 years away from the cult field, you know, I wasn't completely away because I was studying terrorism and gangs and writing novels about these things. But I was no longer the historian of Scientology. I was no longer dealing with ex-members. I came back because I realized that unaided, there is a tendency for the beliefs to persist, you know, even when you've undone the words. Last week, I had a call from a guy who grew up in Scientology and who left it in the last century and was sure that he'd got rid of it all. And then saw something I'd said about the suppressive person doctrine in Scientology, and he said he had to sit down because he'd thought this thing was completely out of his head, and he realized there was still a concept there. And so being willing to question, being willing to challenge, but that can be definitely much more effective in a group of people. as long as you don't have an expert in the room. You know, when I tried to do this, I was the problem because people looked to me, you know, as a somewhat of a know-it-all, to smart aleck, whatever you want.
Right,
but
right.
Because I have such an incredible reservoir of facts about Scientology that they'd want me to say something. So don't let me in the room. That's the first thing. Unless you want to pay me a lot of money, of course. Which nobody does, you know, for some reason. So yeah, having a discussion group, you know, having a small group of friends, and also learning about active listening. That's probably the only thing that I would underline as coming from therapy. Actually, there'll now be 10 or 15 more, but that being able to reflect back to somebody and say, so, you know, if you don't feel you understand what they're saying, being able to go, so are you telling me this, or could you put that right. away? But showing that you're engaged with what they're saying. And if you're not engaged with what they're saying, leave them alone, you know. So there's one thing is talking to help yourself recover, and the other is helping others to talk to recover. Yeah. And as you say, John Gottman, who's done phenomenal work on couples over the many decades, had the couples lab at his university. And he came to this thing. He wrote about children, and he said, you know, with your kids, rather than kind of lecturing them and telling them what's what, let them tell you what they're experiencing to the extent that children are able to do that. And then find a time you made the same mistake and tell them about that. Say, when I was such and such, I did this. And this is how I got out of it, you know.
Right.
And, right. you know, but allowing some kind of parity rather than talking down to people. Exactly. And allowing this concept, which for me is very strong, that I am very happy to give people advice. I'm very happy if they don't follow it. And I'm not going to blame them for not following it. Mm-hmm. I will often ask for advice, and then I'll annoy somebody by telling them I'm not going to take it. You know, that it's been very useful to me to hear their point of view, but I will make the decision about what I do. The simple parallel to that is when I'm working as an editor on somebody else's book, I make it clear at the start that I'm going to be absolutely savage. I'm not going to be polite. I'm going to say, this is how I do it. I'm not going to call them names, probably.
Right.
Yeah. Especially if they're paying me a lot of money, which they aren't. But I am going to just be absolutely brusque, blunt, straightforward, correct or change what I want. But they're still the author. If at the end of the day they want to ignore everything I've said, I'm not going to come back to the book and tell them off. You know?
Right. No, of course.
They're still the boss. And keeping that in mind in any relationship, that the person recovering needs to become the boss, that they've had that, you know, the locus of power has been taken from them. So they need to be able to be in charge of their own thoughts and their own decisions and their own mistakes going forward. Yeah. You know, so not getting into an authoritarian, you know, where you have a little group of people and somebody becomes the leader and is telling everybody else what to do. No, bad idea.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because, you know, I think of, you know, these, I think what you're recommending is great if the opportunity is there, you know, if you get a chance. Like I know for me, the first 15 years of my recovery were very challenging because any ex-member that I reached out to was not in the place where I was. So they were still indoctrinated. So I spent the first 15 years thinking, God, am I the only one that thinks this thing was a cult? Like maybe I'm the crazy one, right? And I found that to be very challenging. And in the last more half a dozen years, I've found, you know, maybe four or five people who I've been able to talk to who've kind of come through their own path and now at a place where we can kind of have that kind of discourse. But I think, you know, one of the challenges that you're up against, and you alluded to this in what you were talking about, is, you know, the getting out of the black and white thinking. You know, the so much of the cult of control is in that thinking in those absolutes and saying something at one moment can be determined to be right or wrong, or good or bad, or evil or ugly or beautiful. And until you kind of have more of, like what you're saying, more of a group context where you can kind of recognize that there's just shades of gray, and that even events you all shared and witnessed as a group, so to speak, you may have all processed it in very different ways, and there's nuances to it, and a lot can be determined in essence by the trauma you brought in before you even got involved with the group. So you've just got a different lens at looking at the world that way. And I find, so much of this is the challenge in just finding the way to communicate, because very often, and we learned this also, I learned this as a performer, as an actor, what you're always trying to do is affect someone. You're trying in essence to communicate something and get a result that will tell you, oh, they've heard what I'm trying to say in the way I'm intending it to be heard, rather than just, oh, I need to say it so I feel I've been clear with what I'm saying. So if I'm just worried about articulating in a way that I feel is clear, but I'm not worried about how it lands on the other person, potentially I'm not communicating very well at all, because my focus is really just, how do I say this in a way where I feel most best represents what I am feeling or what I experienced, but I'm not looking at, is it landing on you in the way that I'm getting the reaction from you that tells me that you're hearing what I'm and feeling what I want you to feel. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a challenge of the whole recovery process, is not only learning and identifying what my feelings are, my thoughts are, but how well can I communicate them so I feel like someone else gets that. Mm-hmm. And then we can find hopefully this common ground where, like you were talking about, and I was talking about earlier, where you can sit in the hole with that person and say, yeah, I've been in, I know what this feels like. And I don't want someone standing up out of the hole and offering to offer me a ladder, because they're looking down on me. I need someone to sit here with me in the pit, so to speak, and talk about what it feels like being in the pit. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's really, it's a two-handed thing, us learning how to communicate better, and then finding the people who are receptive to have that kind of conversation. Mm-hmm. So, it's a challenge, but it's one that, I encourage everyone to do, because I think it yields incredible benefits from not only learning about how to heal, because you start by talking about things, you start to process it differently, but also you become a better communicator, which allows you to share your story in a way where you feel it's more authentic. And, yes. I think that's what's, what you're always hoping to do is, I think in these cultic environments, it's very hard to be seen and heard where we feel where our authentic self is being respected and embraced. Mm-hmm. And I think in that healing process, you're looking to find that in yourself and find others who will hear and see you in that same way, where we feel we're being represented the way that we want to be represented, not only in the way we're talking about, but the way others are perceiving us through the way we're trying to communicate.
Hmm. Yeah. And part of the process of telling one's story is taking charge of the story, which is, of course, taking charge of the past and integrating the past. I was about 18 or something, and I had a conversation with a young woman who I didn't know and never saw again. And she was very distressed because she'd fallen pregnant, and her father was, by her definition, a gangster. Mm. And she was terrified. She was not married to the man she'd fallen pregnant to. And she was terrified. And I made one of those placating sort of I understand statements. And she was furious. She said, how could you possibly understand? Right. And it made me go away and go, well, after some reflection, that it doesn't, you don't have to have had the same trauma as somebody to understand what trauma is.
Right.
And to offer that, to be able to say to somebody, that was you know, that's a dreadful experience you had. That's absolutely horrifying. I mean, I remember when you told me about the hot seat and being sat there and being abused by, you know, verbally by a whole group of people. And I immediately, of course, put it in, it's the Chinese brainwashing program. It was an aspect of the thought reform program, you know, whatever we're going to be calling it this week. They called it brainwashing, the people who suffered from it. So I'm willing, Sinao, it's the Chinese, I'm willing to go with that. But, you know, when you described that to me, my heart sank. You know, what a terrible thing to do to somebody. Now, I've not had that happen to me. Mm. I've had people heckle me and I've had people be abusive to me verbally. But in such a controlled situation where you no longer have agency, you are in a room and these people are doing this to you. And it's torture. It's fundamentally torture that you're being subjected.
It is, yeah.
And so what I can offer is exactly this, that I haven't had that experience. It sounds absolutely awful. And you didn't deserve it. You know, there's nothing that you did to deserve that. And I think that last bit, we often come away from experiences. It's like when, you know, a kid's parents break up and the kid goes, oh, mummy and daddy have broken up because of me.
Yeah.
And so agency goes to the wrong place. So being able to say, you know, this is what happened. This is how it happened. It was wrong. And I didn't deserve it. It's Goodwill Hunting, isn't it? It's not your fault. It's not
That's
your
right.
fault.
You exactly. No, it's true though. Yeah. It's very powerful when you finally accept that. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of these things that actually, you know, you mentioned the hot seat, and I think it's an interesting thing to articulate. When I was just starting coming through my recovery, you know, I was still so embedded from these hot seat experiences and in that scenario, I would have anywhere from 10 to 15. And sometimes when the group was bigger, it would be even larger. And it was literally like a verbal assault. It was led by the cult leader, but everyone had to have their kind of verbal stone in their hand, ready to act, just to throw it. And if you didn't pile on, you got punished, or potentially the whole mob would turn on you. All right. So you had to always keep a couple stones in your hand, you know, metaphorically, to be able to pile on and throw on the why this person was being so terrible, how their behavior was out of accordance with the so-called principles you're living by, and all these sort of things. But the thing I experienced when I was on the hot seat of feeling literally catatonic, because I was so terrified to virtually say anything, because anything could make it worse.
Yeah.
So saying nothing was at least some sense of stability that it couldn't get worse. And I was so convinced that my way of thinking was the problem, right? So I was afraid of myself and whatever thoughts I would come up with. So I didn't want to verbalize any of them because I thought it might expose and make me look even worse. And trying to understand that process was very hard, because you really start to think you're brain damaged on some level, because they're asking you kind of these quite almost basic, simple questions from a certain perspective of, you know, why do you do this? You know, are you so, you know, things. And in that mindset, it just feels like words that you can't even put together, you know, and you start thinking, what is wrong with me? Is there something wrong with my brain? Am I brain damaged? And they're even saying things like that to you, you know, that you are maybe somehow mentally, you know, incapacitated in some way. And it wasn't until, and then what would happen would be, after I would get through the hot seat, you know, experience, which could be an hour or two, sometimes it could be 10 or 12 hours. I mean, you have marathon sessions where you're just there. But after it was finally over, the adrenaline would drain from my body, and I would start having more clear thoughts. And I'm like, oh my God, I could have said this. I could have said that. Like, what's my problem? Why can't I just do this, right? Like maybe there's something really is wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And then as I was going through, so that that's just, you know, that leaves a really deep wound. Mm-hmm. And when I was going through the recovery, I went to this place, the Wellspring, place in Ohio, which no longer exists, unfortunately. But they literally explained it to me on a chalkboard, where they just said, hey, this is the way the brain works under stress. You know, you have the higher cortex, which is your frontal lobe, and then you have the midbrain, and then the, what's it called? The
limbic system, the old brain.
Yeah, exactly. The one that kind of operates, you know, your breathing and things involuntary, all the stuff. So they said, when you are hit with stress, which, you know, a mob coming at you would be stressful, you kick into your fight or flight mode, that midbrain part. And the frontal higher cortex is the one that has all your reasoning abilities, your personality, your problem solving part. So you've kicked into the part of your brain that doesn't access the part that allows you to even articulate or problem solve on any level. And that is what you're experiencing. And that's why the thing that I was, you know, having as my, you know, hot seat experience was explained, like, oh, you were in a state of such high stress that you couldn't think clearly. And that's why when you finally were out of that stress, you could start to think clearly again. So it wasn't that you there was something wrong with you. The nature of the environment was the one that created this thing, so that you adopted this belief system based on what you experienced, not knowing that there is a physiological reason for why you reacted and felt the way you felt. And that was like a weight going off my shoulders. Like, I couldn't believe, I'm like, oh my God, so I'm not brain damaged. There's not something incredibly wrong with me. Like, and that was such a useful piece of information to get, but I only was able to receive it because I had gotten to the point where I realized I needed help and I needed to start telling people about my story, what I experienced, and why it was, you know, why it wasn't sitting well with me, because I hadn't really told anyone. And that was a really, really helpful thing. And that's why I encourage people so much, like, you know, this choice to go into denial, like you said. I mean, yeah, I've been working on this doc series that, you know, telling the story of the group that I was involved with, and many of the ex-members we reached out to there. This is 2 decades out from the time when I dissolved the group, because I confronted them and I sued them and the group kind of dissolved. But the majority of the people, and I'm like 95% of them, to have taken that path of denial on some level and have not in any way healed in 20 years. I mean, actually speaking with them in a strange way, it's nostalgic, because it's like you go, it's like going back in time to the way things were in the cult. There's still the loaded language. There's still the belief system. There's still, and it's like they're stuck in time. But I can see how hard it's got to be for them to live with this, because they virtually have never talked with anyone with any conflicting point of view, other than, you know, like-minded people who they've consulted in to kind of keep the mutual denial. And that to me has been the greatest tragedy of telling my story, is that, yes, I was a lucky one that I kind of figured things out, and I went a very, aggressive recovery path and chose to speak out and become a bit of a, you know, an activist, or, you know, an advocate for other survivors. But the majority have chosen to run from it. And that's where I really realized the lingering effects of trauma when undealt with, how it just, it's like being, you know, you talk about stepping in a dog's mess. Well, it's like you never step out of it.
Yeah.
It's just constantly on your shoes for the rest of your life going forward, if you don't choose to deal with it and use the mechanism to wipe off your shoes, you know, and make sense of it.
Yeah, yeah, rather than wondering why nobody wants to be in the same room with you.
Right, exactly.
The hot seat thing, one of the things that I came to, I haven't seen him for a long time, but my friend Arthur Bookman, who belonged to a group that put him in solitary confinement, where he didn't see another human being for 12 years.
What?
Yeah. And he composed music, in fact, for 12 years. And I had a real push to try and get him to show me this music, because I'm fascinated by this thought of, yeah, he was writing it down. He didn't have an instrument to play, I don't think. But, and somehow he maintained his sanity, very definitely maintained his sanity. But I was talking with him, and I was talking with a woman who'd been in Scientology, who'd been on the Rehabilitation Project Force, and, you know, the horrors that she described, just these awful things. And they were both there at this meeting, and I got them and I said, so the way you coped with this was by pretty much establishing a panic room inside yourself so you could dissociate into that numb space and not feel what was going on. And they both said yes. And
yeah,
I think it makes sense. You know, I'd come to that by reading about victims of torture. So it makes sense to do that. It's a safety precaution and a measure, but I think it tends to persist. And so when you leave the group, there's still this sense of alienation, of separation from the rest of the world. Often, initially, it's a sense of superiority that you belong to the elite, you know, the people chosen by Rajneesh or Sun Myung Moon or Ron Hubbard, right, to be in the vanguard of humanity, to use Nixium.
Right. Yeah.
And that, you know, that can take a while. I had a friend, and he was 10 years an executive in Scientology's SEA organization. And he then left and went looking for a job and found he was only qualified to be a builder's laborer, that none of his executive training in Scientology was recognized in the world. And it was a real, you know, he's a good guy. He has admitted that he was arrogant when he left, and he needed to come down. And, you know, I'm happy to say that the last I heard from him, he was having a very happy existence. So it said it worked for him.
Good.
But yeah, tying ourselves back into the world through our narrative, saying, you know, this is, you know, Hippocrates, I'm told, from whom we have the Hippocratic Oath, said that a medical procedure is not finished until the patient has told everybody what happened.
Oh, interesting.
The first talking cure, long before Freud borrowed the expression from somebody else, as he tended to do. Do we have 5 minutes to talk about love? Because we were talking about love, and I'm quite interested in.
Yes, we do. We do. And before we get that, I just want to give the audience a footnote. There's a doc series called Stolen Youth, which deals with the guy from Sarah Lawrence College.
Yeah, Larry Ray.
Yeah, exactly. And in that, he was such an egomaniac that he thought he should record everything for posterity. And you actually witness the hot seat. Like you've got someone on the hot seat, and you literally, excuse my French, watch him mind fucking someone, where he's convincing people to take responsibility for crimes, and I use that in quotes, that they didn't even commit, so that they can be kind of have some sort of absolution. And you literally watch and witness it is absolutely horrifying. Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, it was luckily, I can't say for myself, it wasn't, you know, triggering, because I feel like I've dealt with a lot of that. But it's like, oh my God, this is the best. I've been trying for so long to relay to people what this experience was like, and like, here it is in Technicolor, this is what it's like. So if people are curious, if they haven't had that experience or whatever, I would say check out that. It's not a great show, because not anyone was really healed when they told this story. So it's more of what a lot of these shows end up being. You're just witnessing a lot of carnage of the mess that's happened from the cultic experience, rather than someone's gone through the tunnel, done some recovery, now has some reflection and kind of can share their lessons learned and the silver lining of the whole thing. So it doesn't really have that part, but as far as showing the hot seat, I think it would be beneficial to, if you're curious, you can check it out.
It's a good time.
But yes, love, you know, I brought it up because, you know, before we started our conversation, because I think, you know, obviously we all want to be loved. We all want to be lovable. And I know actually it's one of the things I still deal with from my cultic experience. Am I lovable? And I really battle that.
You are lovable, Hoyt, definitely.
Well, thank you. Thank you, John. But it's really emerged in many different facets of, you know, I still battle that. And and one of the things I've learned more recently that you and I were talking about was that that's such a powerful word, because, you know, we want that so badly that when even someone uses it in the form of addressing us and hearing the words that we want to hear when someone says, I love you, and how much impact that can be on us. Because the I know for myself, the first reaction is to think of it in the terms that I want to hear it in, of like, you know, that's what I want to hear. And I've learned over time, I also need to take into context, well, what does this person mean when they say that? Like, do they mean the same thing that I mean when I say it? And very often it's not the same thing. And because of that, you end up having conflicting feelings. Like, someone may say, I love you, but the way, if I'm not feeling loved by them, you know, it sends out a mixed message to me. Like, so wait, you're saying you love me, but my goodness, I don't really feel loved by you, or certainly I don't feel good about the way I or aspects of this relationship I'm being treated doesn't feel loving to me, you know? And I think it's really hard to separate the two and say, listen, we're limited by language in that sense. Like, it's more about having to go by, how does the person behave, and how does that behavior affect me, and how do I feel about it, rather than the catch-all word, which seems to, you know, just put the seal of approval on it, where it may not be accurate. And I think that's what's really interesting about trying to find love, is we have to kind of figure out for ourselves what it means, and how would it manifest in a way that would really, you know, feel like it's what we think of when we think of the word. And you know, and I've had friends, you know, talk about that, like, oh, just write down on the list, you know, of what you'd be looking for in a partner, and what are the traits, and what are the, and it's a tricky thing. It really is. But I think ultimately it's a feeling. And are, you know, are you feeling heard and seen? And I know for me personally, like, can I be me and all unabashedly, warts and all, and still feel lovable, or, you know, some of the conditioning I had, my mother was quite kind of domineering in this way. Like, you know, that it was always love with a catch. I'll love you as long as you know, it's conditional love, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, which I think in relationships are important. You got to have conditions, but ultimately, you know, I think we're looking for acceptance and being seen and feeling heard, and feeling like we can really be ourselves, and that part is lovable, and that's a challenge to find.
I had a period of more than 10 years where I wouldn't use the word love, because of exactly what you're saying, that it's, you have to understand what the other person means. And so it seemed better for me to say, you know, I have affection, I have liking for somebody, or I have lust for somebody. Yeah. Or and the more, you know, as time goes by, I've, you know, taken the word back again. It's a nice word. But when I first met Yuval Lahore in 2015, and he within his model was using the word love, and it was still for me a, you know, this word has such a breadth of meaning potentially, what do we mean, right. I mean, let me give you an example. A friend of mine, he many years ago, he had a baby, and the baby would sleep 1 hour a day, and otherwise, and the parents hadn't realized that they needed to separate rooms so that one of them could sleep one night and the other the next night, so they were both trying to look after this baby. And this man, who was a lovely man and a brilliant man, one of the cleverest people I've met, he said, of course I love my son, but I don't like him. And it was the first time that differentiation had occurred to me, that you could actually feel that obligation of love, but dislike the person you were loving. And, you know, my first child was born at the same time as his. I have four now, and I understand the distinction between liking and loving much better. So,
well, I'll give you a quick antidote. The Italians say, when your children are infants, they're just so cute. You wish you could eat them. And by the time they're teenagers,
you wish you had.
Yeah. So I've heard that, you know, so you're a parent. I'm sure you can identify. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, Aaron Beck, the founder of cognitive therapy, which has morphed off into cognitive behavioral therapy, not the same thing. But I still quite like Beck's approach to it, but I was introduced to him through a book called Love Is Never Enough, about 30 years ago. And while as a therapy for couples, which is, I think, what it was meant to be, I'm not sure it's the best thing. I think John Gottman had better ideas. But nonetheless, his explanation that, you know, you will have certain expectations that come from your family background and your life, and the person you're meeting will have different expectations. You then have the problem of mind reading, the expectation that you'll know how the person is thinking and feeling. And these things can be so incredibly different.
Yeah.
You know, and so resolving what the conditions of love are is important. And I constantly refer back to The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm, as a manual that I think probably everybody should read, along with Jiang Su. That's a good thing to read too. But he has this story, about, you know, if you want to be a painter, then going, well, when I see the right subject, I will paint it. But you have to learn how to paint. And I think love's absolutely that. For me, one of the greatest challenges of my life, I went on a formal intervention back in 1991. And I was sleep deprived for a week. It was the first time that had ever happened to me. It's a commonplace for other people, but not for me. And we were successful. We were tremendously harassed. There were 7 carloads of Scientologists. They'd found out where we were. We were under observation every day. We had to skip that. We found ourselves involved with this guy who was very helpful, who'd been part of the counter-terrorist section of the Special Boat Squadron, which is like the SAS, called 14 Int. And so every day we were going, 4 days, we were going through this cloak and dagger thing of they knew where we were, but they didn't know where the person we were talking to, and they never did. And it got pretty scary. And it threw me into a position when I got home that I questioned everything. Why do I believe what I believe? What's going on? And I started, things started to creak a little in my mind. And I came to, I call them unquestionable assumptions. And my unquestionable assumption came from infancy and the idea being brought up in the Christian church that I should love everybody. Everybody. I should love them. Mm. And for 3 days, I remember, vividly still, I went through this process of going, well, of course that's true, that's right, I mustn't question that, I mustn't challenge that. And eventually I did challenge it, and I said, I don't want to deliberately harm anyone, but I am under no obligation to love Pol Pot, Hitler,
right.
Quite a lot of other people actually, and it puts me at a weak point, if I'm desperately trying to help people who are Machiavellian and psychopathic in their behavior. So, but I bring that up as a, what is love and what do we mean by love? And in the Christian, you have caritas, you have agape, you have these different forms of love, which I think is real. Apparently when John Bowlby left the Freudian fold and developed attachment theory, and there's an overlap in those periods, which is quite interesting. And he said, he said to his wife, well, what should I call this? And she said, well, it's love. And he's like, oh, no, I can't use that word. Let's call it attachment,
Yeah.
And it is about that. And it does say that there are these 4 different kinds of attachment that could be seen as 4 different kinds of love. Alex Stein does a very good job in, where has it gone? Terror, Love, and Brainwashing. It's down here somewhere. It's Terror, Love, and, oh, it is called Terror, Love and Brainwashing. There you go.
Oh, there
she
you
talks
go.
About, oh, I remembered something. She talks about disorganized attachment, this idea that the person that you're dependent upon for your comfort is also the person who's abusing you. So the parent who says, oh, come here, come here, come here, I love you, and slaps you when you arrive. And which I absolutely accept. I personally separate out attachment theory as it applies to children and as it applies to adults. I think we have to be careful not to mix those things up. But I think she's right that in adulthood you can create a dependent relationship where the person that you're loving, the cult leader that you love,
yeah,
may in their own terms love you, but their own terms are narcissistic and they
right.
will exploit
no.
you, you know.
Oh God, that's so on point, John. Yeah, that's right. I think again, because that would be a great example of me going back to that statement of someone saying they love you, and that was part of the, you know, they called that the love bombing phase, right? Where you know, I came into the group and everyone's like, oh, we love you, so like right off the bat, I don't even know these people.
Yeah,
but hearing that was so intoxicating. I mean, it's one of those things that. We're not coached when we're young that feeling good too fast is potentially a red flag. And, yes. And the love bombing is like, hey, listen, you could have wonderful parents who tell you they love you all the time and are encouraging, but still when you get it that much by that many different people, you start thinking it's like mainlining a drug. And without knowing that was potentially dangerous, it just felt fantastic. You know, I try to tell people that the indoctrination process, once it kind of hits full swing, is tied to incredibly positive emotional state. You know, you think you're discovering the truth, you're finding your tribe, you're finding your purpose. You know, all these sort of things are incredibly exhilarating, and that's why it's so hard to see through the mess, you know, afterwards, because you're so excited for what you signed up for. You know, it took me 20 years to figure out what I signed up for when I was actually involved. We're you know, light years apart.
Diametrically opposite.
Yeah, but I got there, you know, and that's where I realized, and we've talked about this, you know, many times. It's one of my favorite points we address is to figure out what happened to you very often requires recognizing that you did have the wool pulled over your eyes, you know, and that's why my new favorite quote is, it's a much easier to fool a person than to convince a person they've been fooled. And that's really where the rubber meets the road. And unless you have the humility to admit to yourself that you kind of got taken and conned, you just don't give yourself much opportunity to start that healing process. And that love bombing stuff is really, really intense when you can't separate, well, what are they doing? Or how are they treating me compared to really what I interpret loving behavior to be and what loving behavior to feel like, you know, when I, and all those sort of things. It's, you know, that word is just very powerful, can be very manipulative. And we all on some level want to hear it, but very often it can be expressed in a way that might not be productive or counter, you know, counter to what we actually, and you know, associate with that word. And that takes some investigation, which I encourage us all to do.
Yeah, and I think it talking with the people that you love about what they mean by love.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea that people who love you are going to sit for hours throwing stones at you in the hot seat. Well, forgiveness is an aspect of love. Redemption is an aspect of love. And the sort of the conditions that as long as you keep giving us money, as long as you keep, you know, no. Yeah. And as you say, if, you know, if there's one thing, and there are quite a lot of things, but if there's one thing that I could get over to the coming generation, it would be when somebody pretends to be your best friend, they're pretending. When somebody you don't know comes up to you and starts telling you how wonderful you are, there are various possibilities. A, they suffer from bipolar disorder and they're in a manic phase and they love everybody. B, right. They've taken too much MDMA and then they're loved up. C, right. they're psychopaths and they want to control you.
Right.
And D, yeah, they've become infatuated with you, but that's not a good thing.
Right.
So none of these things are healthy. And
yeah.
Also, you have to separate out that, you know, psychopaths can be charming. Well, actually, yeah, all right, they can. But to then reject anybody who's charming, to reject anybody who's generous, anybody who's pleasant, because you are suspicious. Well, actually, at the beginning of a relationship, it's probably a good idea to be cautious. And when you've realized that somebody really is what they say they are, they really are a good person who seeks to do good, or if they have a track record, you know, you and I are in this enviable position that we've spent so long doing this that you know, it's hard to throw those stones at us, because we can point to the past and say, well, I did this, you know. But doing that little process of accounting and finding out from somebody, you know, even straight up saying, you know, I don't know you, what, why are you doing this? Is there something you want to sell me?
Yeah. Is there potentially an agenda behind your behavior? Yeah. Yeah. No, cool. I think it's a good thing to think about. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And I think we've actually
I think we covered it.
Yeah,
exactly. Well, I can say I love you, John. I really love you too.
I love our
friendship, and I'm very grateful that you're in my life. And I enjoy our talks, and it's always very special. So
the same for me. Absolutely the same for me, Hoyt.
Well, until the next time.
Consider yourself lovable from here on.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
I'll send you a little certificate you put on the wall. John says I'm lovable.
Okay, sounds good.
And anybody that wants to send me $10, I'll do that.
That's right. We'll take it in that form as well. I hear you.
Oh dear. So yeah, great pleasure. Thank you very much. And
okay, please, until the next time.
Until we meet again. So
all right. All the
thanks
best.
For it.
All right. Bye bye.
Hi, John here. Thanks for watching. We'd appreciate it very much if you would click like, as well as subscribe, and click the bell for notifications. Every dollar helps, and we welcome new patrons on Patreon, or you can make a one-off payment with any currency through PayPal. Thanks so much.